From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now. To Waukesha, Wisconsin now, a community still reeling from last night's tragedy at a holiday parade. Authorities say the suspect who plowed an SUV through the crowd may have been fleeing another incident. At least 5 people killed, more than 40 injured. Angela O'Boyle witnessed the incident from her apartment balcony. She told CNN she saw the car speed down the street and hit a marching band.
The next thing I heard were screams and turned my head and saw the car come and plow into the band that was just past my balcony at that point. It hit at least 2 people right away, rolled over both of them, and then continued down the road.
We're joined now by Marty Mickelson with member station WUWM in Milwaukee. Marty, must be terrible, terrible feelings there. But what is the latest that we're hearing?
Waukesha authorities say they are still gathering information and they'll be holding a news conference in about an hour from now. But what we know so far is at least 5 people are dead and more than 40 were injured after an SUV driver broke through a police barricade and sped through the parade late yesterday afternoon, striking people who were marching in the event. The incident unfolded on the city's live stream and on many parade goers' cell phone cameras, with videos showing a chaotic scene and one of just unimaginable shock and grief.
Yeah.
Police Chief Daniel Thompson said at a news conference last night that a person of interest is in custody and the SUV used in the incident has been recovered. But law enforcement sources speaking to the Associated Press on condition of anonymity identified the suspect today as 39-year-old Daryl Brooks of Milwaukee. Those sources say investigators are looking into whether the driver was fleeing a crime involving a knife at the time. Chief Thompson hasn't yet confirmed the suspect's identity.
Yeah. Police tried to stop the car at a barricade, but nobody's made any mention of any connection to terrorism or the Kyle Rittenhouse not guilty verdict.
Right. Police have not really officially talked about motive yet. Chief Thompson said last night that it's unknown whether this is connected to terrorism. Also, it's not known yet whether this is connected to the Rittenhouse trial and verdict of not guilty on all counts against him. That verdict was handed down on Friday.
Yeah. But as you said, there is a name being reported there. Authorities have said that he may have been fleeing another incident. As this news trickles out, how is the community there reacting?
Well, the Waukesha School District canceled classes today and said extra counselors would be on hand for students and staff. Also, an emotional distress hotline has been set up for the community at large, and the city of Waukesha is asking people to bring memorials to Veterans Park, which is near the scene. Many people as well on the city's social media pages are weighing in. People who live in Waukesha and people who grew up in Waukesha but have moved away are pouring out their grief on these pages. Plus, people from across the country are sending their condolences. Just a little personal note, I am from Waukesha myself, and I can tell you it's a very, very tight-knit community.
Yes, it is. Marty Mickelson with member station WWM there, as she said, in her hometown, Waukesha.
And now to Missouri, where a black man is seeking exoneration this week after 43 years in prison for triple murder. Kevin Strickland has long maintained his innocence, and now prosecutors are fighting on his side. One of the key details at issue is Strickland's hair. Here's Jackson County Prosecutor Gene Peters Baker in a hearing this month.
You don't have to know a lot about black hair, but you have to know a little to know these are not fresh braids.
Luke Martin is covering this for member station KCUR. Hi, Luke.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
So, help us understand the basics. Who is Kevin Strickland, and why was he convicted of triple murder that happened back in 1978?
Kevin Strickland was 18 years old at the time when he was convicted of this triple murder here in Kansas City. The killings were very gruesome. There were 4 people shot. 3 of those people ended up dying. One of them, Cynthia Douglas, survived because she lost consciousness. Douglas identified to police two of the four shooters by name, but she didn't identify Strickland, who she had known for a couple of years, until the next day when she picked him out of a police lineup. Strickland's original conviction hinged on Douglas's testimony against him, partly because there just wasn't a lot of other evidence tying him to the scene.
Yeah, so he was convicted to 50 years in prison, I believe. And now, more than 40 years on, why are prosecutors arguing he's innocent?
Yeah, so earlier this year, Prosecutor Jean Peters Baker took on this months-long review of new evidence in Strickland's case. This evidence was presented to her by the Midwest Innocence Project. She announced in May that she also thought Strickland was innocent. The problem was that there was no way for local prosecutors in Missouri to revisit cases like these where a bad verdict is suspected until this summer, when the state legislature passed a massive bipartisan public safety bill that included a provision giving prosecutors that ability. So soon after that happened, Baker petitioned a judge on Strickland's behalf. There's several things that point to Strickland's innocence here. None of his prints on the shotgun in question, nor were there any in the house where this crime occurred. Baker also contends that Douglas, that lone eyewitness, wanted to recant her testimony against Strickland for years. Baker called up, you know, many of Douglas's family and friends to the stand, and they testified that Douglas felt pressured by police to identify Strickland back in 1978.
Now, one of the key pieces of this is his hair. Strickland was, as you described, ID'd in a lineup, and the picture shows his hair in braids. But the witness, Ms. Douglas, said the shooter had natural hair, that it was not braided. Why is this important?
Yeah, the question here is really whether Strickland could have gotten his hair braided between 8 p.m. Tuesday night when the murders occurred and 6 a.m. the next morning when he first met with police. I talked to a pair of experienced hair braiders here in Kansas City, Kansas, Glennis and Shelley Smith. They estimated braiding Strickland's hair like it appears in his booking photo. That would probably take about an hour or two. So timing-wise, it's definitely possible. But the other thing to consider is that the quality of the braids in the photograph, they're clearly not fresh. In the mugshot, Strickland's hair is braided in about 10 or 12 sections. Each section is tied in what's called a plait, about the size of a pinky finger. So this is a really common braiding technique. But in Strickland's photo, those lines between each of the plaits where the scalp is exposed, those lines are ill-defined and a little bit fuzzy. So when I showed the Smith sisters this mugshot, they told me that they see about a week's worth of new hair growth here.
You can see the plait growing away from the scalp. So that's new growth. And you cannot have new growth within 24 hours.
Now, on the other side, the state attorney general argues Strickland is guilty and that he received a fair trial. What's the evidence on that side?
You know, during the hearing, the AG's attorneys basically argued that it is within the realm of possibility for Strickland to have his hair braided between the time of the murders and the mugshot. The attorneys have also pointed out that one of Strickland's fingerprints was on the getaway vehicle. As for these witnesses, the family and friends who say that Douglas wanted to recant, the attorney general has basically said that all of that testimony amounts to hearsay and the judge shouldn't consider it.
Now, Strickland was convicted by an all-white jury, and this case has sparked more debate over race and cultural competency in the courtroom. How's that been playing out?
I think it's worth mentioning here that Strickland's conviction came during his second trial. During Strickland's first trial, there was a single black juror, and that trial ended in a hung jury. Research suggests that a biased conviction is more likely when a jury is homogenous. For whatever reason, we see that a diverse jury results in more, you know, wide-ranging discussions of the facts in a case. I also spoke with retired Judge Ladaris Hazard Cordell. She was the first African-American woman on the Superior Court of Northern California. She told me Strickland's situation could have been far different if more black people had been involved in his trial.
There is no question that a black person raised in a black community who was either a judge or an attorney on either side or a juror would absolutely know right away that something was wrong.
Luke, any thoughts on when the judge could render a decision?
Yeah, we really don't know at this point. Today is basically the last day for attorneys to get the judge paper versions of all of their evidence and arguments that they've made. The judge told the courtroom, you know, he would be making a decision in a timely manner, but there's no timetable or schedule for that.
Well, indeed, if he is freed, Strickland would be the longest wrongful imprisonment case in state history, so certainly worth watching. Luke Martin, reporter for KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Protests broke out in several cities over the weekend, although nothing major in Kenosha, Wisconsin, after the acquittal in a courthouse there of Kyle Rittenhouse, found not guilty of all charges Friday in the killing of two people, the wounding of another, during protests last summer over the police shooting of a black man in Kenosha. Gun rights groups and supporters of former President Trump are celebrating the Rittenhouse acquittal. Tucker Carlson of Fox News had a documentary team embedded with Rittenhouse during the trial. A portion of Carlson's post-verdict interview will be airing tonight. Here's some of that.
This case has nothing to do with race. It never had anything to do with race. It had to do with the right to self-defense.
Right.
I'm not a racist person. I support the BLM movement. I support peacefully demonstrating.
Let's bring in author and historian Ibram X. Kendi, founding director of Boston University's Center for Anti-Racist Research. He recently posted a piece he wrote in 2020 for The Atlantic in which he said that the Rittenhouse case was part of a summer of a defense of white supremacy. Now, Professor Kendi, you just heard Rittenhouse say not only is he not a white supremacist, he says he supports the Black Lives Matter movement. The men he killed were white, and he said that he killed them in self-defense. One tried to grab his rifle, another attacked him with a skateboard. So flesh out this thinking that you've long had that this is about white supremacy and not self-defense.
Well, I think it's important for us to know that during the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s, there were white people who were assassinated and killed as they fought for the voting rights or the civil rights of African Americans. There were white people who were lynched as a result of their anti-racist activism. And there were white enslavers who inflicted violence, and just as lynchers did, in the name of self-defense. And so for the longest time, white supremacists have engaged in violence, claimed they were engaged in self-defense, and harmed everyone, including white people.
Well, and in this case, legal experts tell NPR Rittenhouse had a strong case because in Wisconsin, the law allows someone to use deadly force if they believe, reasonably, they're in imminent danger of death or great bodily harm. And once a defendant has made a self-defense claim, prosecutors then have to disprove it beyond a reasonable doubt. Those are pretty, you know, high bars. And we're also hearing from legal analysts that there's something called the gun quatrain, some are calling it, that if you have a gun and you bring a gun into a public place, that's number one. Number two, somebody sees it, they get afraid. They think, what's that person doing with an AK, whatever it is, you know, an assault rifle? Three, they try to take that away. Then you can claim, as we're hearing in the Ahmaud Arbery case, that the person with the gun then feels afraid and they have a right to self-defense. Do you worry that this is becoming something of the theme?
I think that is one of the greatest worries that I have, and I know many people have expressed over the last few days and really over the last few months and years. And that is that somebody who has worked with or praised white supremacist organizations can bring an AR-15 to an anti-racist demonstration. People could seek to disarm that person in fear that they would harm somebody. And then that person who brought the AR-15 can shoot to kill and then claim self-defense and be exonerated. And I think that's what people fear, because that's going to cause more people to want to bring weapons to peaceful protests and claim self-defense if they end up killing someone.
Yeah. Well, when you say these trials and other things that we're seeing, tweets from former President Trump, are about maintaining white supremacy, make that case even broader.
So to understand the history of white supremacist ideology, is to understand that white supremacist organizations, white supremacist individuals have long claimed they are engaging in violence to defend themselves or to defend white people. To give an example, one of the most prevailing white supremacist theories right now is this idea of white genocide, that the nation is being invaded by people of color and that white people are being harmed by racism. And so therefore white people need to defend against this genocide through violence. And so what that means is that when that violence is aggressive and engaged, people are imagining that it's self-defense.
Yeah. Do you have any doubt as you look at, you know, the images of a Kyle Rittenhouse, who does seem to, you know, the Wisconsin law does seem to uphold his defense, but the image of him, you know, shooting two people and then walking brazenly afterwards, or the image of three white men trailing a black jogger, some would say terrorizing him. Do you have any doubt that if those images were flipped and it was, you know, Kyle Rittenhouse was black, Ahmaud Arbery was white and being trailed by three black people, do you have any doubt that the sentiment would be different?
So I have no doubt that if the roles were reversed, that a black person, you know, would be convicted. And one of the reasons is, you know, I remember the case of Marissa Alexander, who was a black woman who had been abused physically by her husband. And on a particular day when her husband was coming to yet again abuse her, she shot a weapon over his head to stop him from that abuse in Florida, in a state with your stand your ground law. And she was still convicted. And so from that case and from so many other cases where black people have tried to use self-defense and were still convicted, it shows me that it's hard for black people to win on self, I should say to be acquitted, you know, on self-defense when it's so routine for white people to claim self-defense and be acquitted.
Author, historian Ibram X. Kendi, founding director of Boston University's Center for Anti-Racist Research. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
In Iowa, the state's largest water utility is preparing for a very wet spring after almost 2 years of drought. And to do that, Des Moines has made costly upgrades to its water treatment facilities. And other water systems across the country may have to do the same. Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters reports on how water quality issues are exacerbating climate change problems in farm country.
While nitrate occurs naturally, it's also a byproduct of nitrogen fertilizer, and Iowa farmers use lots of that to grow their corn and soybeans. Nitrate finds its way into surface and groundwater that eventually becomes drinking water. Studies have linked ingesting too much nitrate in drinking water to cancer, and that concerns retired teacher Janice Elliott, who spent about $1,000 on a reverse osmosis system in her home in the small Iowa town of Avon.
So this is the safe water. Just that little thing there.
Elliot started testing the water from her private well for nitrates about 5 years ago. The EPA health standard in the U.S. is 10 parts per million. What finally got Elliot and her husband to install this pricey device was when the nitrate level got up to 19 parts per million.
Which is almost double the federal legal limit for drinking water. So we were drinking poison for a year.
Larger water utilities have been treating this problem for years. Take Des Moines Water Works, for example. It gets most of its water for its 600,000 customers from the Raccoon and Des Moines Rivers. Ted Corrigan is the utility's CEO and says last summer there were toxins on the Des Moines River that made it unusable. Add to that, climate change is creating another problem.
We also see issues with the quantity of nutrient that is stored on the landscape because of the drought. Now we have excess nutrients in the soil. We hope for rain, but if it does rain, we have the potential for extremely high nitrates. It's not a sustainable situation.
Waterworks has upgraded its facility and constructed deep wells to store more water, and it's looking at building additional groundwater wells. More than 90 miles upstream from Des Moines, Mark Sleisman farms with his father and kids in Calhoun County near the Raccoon River. He's showing me a large wetland on his property that hooks up to an irrigation system so he can reuse the water on his land.
This is something that we can say, yep, it helps the river because we're keeping nitrates here or reducing them. But it also helps me because I'm getting water on this field and I'm reusing the nitrogen also.
Sleisman says farmers know what tools to use, but they're costly and can be cumbersome. While politicians here insist Iowa is making good progress with nitrate in water, University of Iowa Geographical and Sustainability Sciences professor Sylvia Secchi disagrees. She argues that the federal farm bill essentially subsidizes farmers to pollute.
What we need to do is we need to ask for some environmental outcome for all the money we give to farmers. And that will reduce the load so that the utilities don't have to spend so much money cleaning up the water that we drink.
And Secchi says it's a bigger concern for utilities in smaller cities and residents who rely on their private wells that may have nitrate-tainted water. The challenges in Iowa are similar to those in other places surrounded by farmland, especially as they increasingly face drastic weather swings that affect drinking water. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in Des Moines.
One thing on the menu for many families this Thanksgiving week is COVID tests you can do at home. Thing is, they can be hard to find, and they're not particularly cheap either. Here to explain is Catherine Wu. She's science writer for The Atlantic. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
It's good to have you. So let's talk about the shortage. First of all, demand, I understand, has been soaring, not just from families planning to get together like mine, but companies bringing people back into the office as well, just a lot of demand everywhere?
Yeah, absolutely. It is testing season for sure in the U.S. I think compared to last year, people are more aware of these tests. They really want them. I cannot tell you how many questions I have gotten from friends and family about testing in the past few weeks.
Yeah, your friends and mine. And then, of course, there's the supply side of all of this. And you write in your article that there are many reasons. I gather one of them is manufacturers of these at-home tests, you know, back in the summer, like a lot of us thought COVID was ending or easing. And so maybe they, you know, bet against production, pulled back a little bit.
Tests are kind of in short supply. They're certainly easier to find on pharmacy shelves and online than they were even a few weeks ago. And that's great news, but they're still super expensive. People are still refreshing web pages. And I think this goes all the way back to, you know, the FDA being really cautious about greenlighting these tests early on. And then by the time they really got around to it, case numbers seem to be ebbing in the winter. A lot of testing sites shut down. A lot of manufacturers thought, we may not need to really just ramp up production anymore. And then cases rose and they had to sort of scramble to catch up. And I think they've been struggling to sort of beat back the tide ever since.
So that leaves us on this Thanksgiving week with a shortage. Your article goes into how you kind of shopped around at all these pharmacies, which a lot of us have done as well. Now we're left with tests that are pricey. In our house, we're going to have 19 people over, so 19 people times $20 or more for a set of tests, upwards of $400 for one holiday. Is there any sense that more tests will be coming, say, in a month, by Christmas, since we know the Biden administration is injecting, you know, several billion dollars into this effort?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people are projecting that we will be, you know, in the neighborhood of about 200 million tests available per month by the end of December. But, you know, that's still a ways away. And, you know, we have 330 million people in this country. That's certainly not enough for all of us to be testing ourselves even weekly. And right now, I think, you know, you're exactly right. There is a huge pricing issue. Right now, tests are just really out of reach for most people because of the price, because of the access situation.
I've read that in Europe and elsewhere in the world, they have a lot more choices. They have a lot more supply. Any idea why?
Yeah, and I do think this comes down to regulation and sort of, you know, the capacity and enthusiasm for these tests. In a lot of places in Europe, in the UK, you can get rapid tests for, you know, $3 less. In some places, they are handing them out for free. It is a pretty sweet situation. You know, I've had friends travel recently to the UK and they came back with suitcases full of tests that have been cleared in Europe for months, and they're coming back to, you know, people saying, oh, you know, you are only allowed to buy a maximum of two tests from CVS at a time and be ready to pay $50 for those two packs. It is an enormous disparity, and I think that could get us into some sticky situations this winter.
That's Catherine Wu, science writer for The Atlantic. Catherine, great to talk to you.
Thanks so much.
A question. Can we safely transplant organs from people who've had COVID-19 after they test negative for COVID but later die? There are those who worry the virus lingers even after people test negative, even after they die. You might remember Nick Guta. We spoke to him earlier this year after his wife, Heidi Ferrer, died by suicide during a debilitating battle with long-haul COVID. She'd signed up to be an organ donor years earlier, something her husband supported at that time. But after she died and her organs were harvested, he's now on something of a mission against donations from long-term patients. He shared this statement with us. Right now, we know so little about how long-term COVID affects all the organs in the body, it seems extremely irresponsible to be implanting them into people who are already immunosuppressed. I know my wife, and she would never have wanted her organs put into another person after the 13 months of excruciating physical suffering she endured. Well, researchers agree there is risk involved, but there are ways to minimize it. And that risk is offset by need. Dr. David Claussen is Chief Medical Officer at the United Network for Organ Sharing. Dr. Claussen, you've said that this is kind of a risk-benefit calculation for the 100,000 people on organ transplant lists, about 17 of whom die every day while waiting for a transplant. What's that calculation?
You have it absolutely right. There is a serious risk-benefit calculation that has to go on in transplant, and that has really always been the case. As you pointed out, there are 100,000 people on the list, but we will do about 40,000 transplants this year. Many of the people on the list, though, really are incredibly ill. Their life expectancy can be down to a matter of days, and the decision to accept or not accept an organ really is extremely important. I believe the pandemic has changed that calculation a little bit, but nonetheless, it still is an important consideration.
In other words, they may say, you know what, it's worth it to me. I only have a day to live. If I get a transplant and in 3 months get COVID, it's worth it to me. But what happens now? There is screening. What happens?
There always has been robust screening of donors, you know, going back many, many years. And that, you know, has continued in the COVID era as well. Donors are screened for a variety of potential infections. 100% of donors are screened for COVID. But nonetheless, we have to realize that there are small risks that remain associated with transplantation.
Well, but we understand that people who test negative, those organs are considered safe for transplantation. We're talking about the deceased, of course. These are people who've passed. Mm-hmm. But is there a ruling? Let's say somebody recovered from COVID-19 months ago, or let's say they might have died of complications of COVID-19, but they still test negative. Is there any kind of requirement or ruling about whether or not their organs can be used?
You have to remember, you know, nearly 50 million people in our country have had COVID and recovered from it. These individuals should really have essentially no risk of communicating COVID to a recipient. Oh. There are patients who, you know, come into a hospital and die, perhaps, of other causes that occasionally are found to test positive for COVID. And as this whole pandemic is evolving, we have been able to evaluate cases like that on a case-by-case basis to assess them as possible donors.
Well, if somebody passes and tests positive for COVID, would you use that organ?
Generally not. Although COVID is primarily a lung disease, patients can have positive testing long beyond the period of time when they are able to transmit an infection. So again, on a case-by-case basis, organs have been successfully used from patients who do remain with a positive test.
Well, so I'm hearing you say that the need is so much, and most of the experience has been that transplant recipients who get an organ from people who tested positive for COVID do well. That's what I think I'm hearing you say. And yet, we also know that, according to reporting in the New York Times, a woman was infected with the coronavirus after receiving the lungs of a donor. That donor had tested negative for the virus. So now the thinking is that lungs are the exception.
The lung situation is more complicated. You know, as this has evolved, we've discovered it is possible for a lung donor to have a negative upper airway COVID test, but still have a positive lower airway test. And so it's now mandatory that all lung donors have both upper and lower testing for COVID. And if those tests are positive, then lung transplants are not done.
And we just want to make sure that we're clear here. So many in your field are saying lungs should not be transplanted, because again, that's where COVID-19 was thought to live and do its most damage. But anything below, abdominal organs, like kidneys or livers, even if the donors have tested positive for the virus, so long as those donors were asymptomatic, those organs are thought to be usable.
That is the current thinking, and there are numbers of cases like that now that have been demonstrated to be safe, specifically for liver and kidney transplantation. Lung transplantation, obviously, is a more complicated situation.
Right. And again, when you say patients, we mean the donors, right?
We mean the donors, excuse me, the donor.
Well, but then we come to long COVID, which is what Nick Gutta is so concerned about. His wife's symptoms were debilitating. And then his concern also was that she was trying, you know, these sham treatments like ivermectin that had destroyed her liver. He was worried about that. What do you do about that situation? That patient had signed an organ donor card, but here the family is giving you information about why her organs should not be transplanted.
Again, I want to emphasize that the donor evaluation is really extensive. It looks at patient safety, recipient safety, but it also looks very carefully at organ function. And if there is evidence that the organ in question is not functioning, then it's not procured for transplantation. So again, I think long COVID is something that we are learning about. You know, it takes many different forms, and so it's hard to make any hard and fast rules about patients that have long COVID. That being said, testing and screening that goes into donor evaluations really allows us to transplant organs from donors that may have had long COVID with being confident of the safety of that.
Boy, doctor, I don't envy you having to make these Solomon-like decisions. And how worried are you? And, you know, Nick Gutta has real fears and he feels that it's his role to speak them. But how worried are you? It's hard enough to get organ donors. I have signed my license. It's right on my license. But how worried are you that this will discourage people?
Organ donation has been growing really steadily for the past decade. The COVID pandemic did change things fairly dramatically in the first couple of months, but it has rebounded. And organ donation actually is proceeding, you know, in a robust fashion, even during the pandemic.
Well, it's a bit of a miracle there. And by the way, we should mention that organ recipients have also had a unique challenge in the pandemic, in that because of the medication they take that suppresses their immune systems so that they don't reject that gift, that organ, they're also more vulnerable to COVID. Are you worried that that makes them more vulnerable possibly to COVID from the transplant?
That is a very serious concern. It's well known that organ transplant recipients do not respond as well to vaccination, and that should they acquire COVID, although this is true for other infections as well, they do not have necessarily as good an outcome. And so certainly that is an important consideration for transplant recipients, you know, in terms of being vaccinated before transplant, if at all possible.
Well, it's also why the rest of us wear masks to protect them.
Certainly.
Dr. David Claussen, Chief Medical Officer at the United Network for Organ Sharing, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
And Dr. Claussen also says he hopes that the extensive screening process and consultation with patients and their families and the families of recipients will bring Nick Gutta some solace. There's more information about donating organs, including how to become a donor, at hereandnow.org.
Across the U.S., hundreds of thousands of homes are at risk of chronic flooding in the next few decades. That's because of sea level rise. And one of the most threatened areas is Southeast Virginia, where people are elevating their homes, installing flood pumps, and adding to seawalls. But some cities are just surrendering land to the sea. Sam Turkin of member station WHRO reports.
The Fernwood Farms neighborhood in Chesapeake looks like any other suburb. Dozens of homes neatly next to each other. But the Elizabeth River runs along part of the neighborhood. Get closer to the water, and suddenly the area is gap-toothed with several empty lots.
So this is one. Property number two is here, right in between two homes.
Welcome to Ground Zero and Chesapeake's quest to retreat from flood-prone land. Rob Braidwood's our tour guide today. He's the city's emergency services coordinator.
This is four.
Five, six.
Yeah.
Once homes, they're now grassy fields. Some have signs along the street. No dumping, keep Chesapeake beautiful. This area used to be a swamp before the city developed it in the 1960s. Now, the water's taking it back. King tides a few times a year can turn streets into lakes. Bring in a hurricane or nor'easter, living rooms become swimming pools.
You can feel how wet this ground is underfoot.
Yeah, and it's not like it's really rained.
It hasn't rained for a couple days.
Braidwood says Chesapeake's been buying out homes around here since 2005, all voluntary. Here's how it works. The city goes to someone whose house floods and says, hey, you keep paying for expensive repairs and the government's helping because you have federal flood insurance. What if we buy your home for fair market value?
Tear this building down. No one ever builds here again.
Convert it to green space. It's a win-win, saving you money.
So I would love to buy every house that floods. Let's use this and see if we can reduce the risk of the entire community.
Citywide, Chesapeake has done it over 40 times. Braidwood says people usually take the deal when they're sick of the flooding, like the Creek MERS.
Hi.
Come on in.
Hello.
Gloria and John Creekmer and their daughter Kim have lived in this two-bedroom condo in Chesapeake for the last 5 years. But it's not where they thought they'd be. You see, back in the 60s, Gloria and John built themselves a red brick home in Fernwood Farms with big windows, a huge yard.
It was like we had birthed a baby before we had children. We were very prideful about our home.
But it was near the Elizabeth River and started flooding a lot, causing hundreds of thousands of dollars in damages. So by the time Rob Braidwood came around several years ago, they couldn't turn down his offer. They sold. Kim pulls out her iPhone and plays a video of the excavator demolishing the house.
So I feel a little sadness, but can't live in the past. Still, I keep the memories, the sweet memories of a beginning of a dream home, our first home.
These decisions, retreating from flood-prone land, they've happened tens of thousands of times nationwide in recent decades. New York, after Superstorm Sandy. Charlotte. Houston. It's up to the city or state to offer buyouts. The federal government can help fund them.
I'm A.R. Siders. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Delaware, and I study climate change adaptation.
Siders says, look, in some areas, other resilience efforts, like higher seawalls, could work. But in the most at-risk neighborhoods, it's futile. Around Virginia, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration forecasts sea levels could rise another 7 feet this century. So why spend money on defenses over and over again if the property will inevitably go underwater and become worthless?
For every dollar we spend on managed retreat, the estimates are that you save $4 to $8. So that's a pretty incredible return on investment financially in terms of avoiding those losses.
Still, there are several barriers to buyouts. Your house likely has to have flooded in the past. Funding is limited, and it can take years to deal with government bureaucracy, a complicated process. There's also politics. Gloucester County, Virginia used to buy out homes, 29 actually. Then some new members took over the Board of Supervisors and ended the program in 2018. Philip Bazzani led the revolt.
We don't want to get involved in any kind of real estate ownership. We don't want to do that. I'm a conservative libertarian, so I want the government to just leave me alone.
The other challenge is, remember, this is voluntary. And that makes things really tricky if folks enjoy fishing and kayaking from their backyards. Take Addie Red and her husband, who've lived on the Elizabeth River in Norfolk for about 2 decades. Floods have inundated parts of their house twice. Now, projections show it underwater by 2060. And yet, Addie has no plans to say goodbye.
Any water you move to in the area is going to be the same thing at some point, right?
Well, what if you just don't live right on the water?
We want to live right on the water.
I know, but this is a coastal region. There's water everywhere. What's a 15-minute drive to the water?
No. Mm-mm.
Climate adaptation experts say many properties don't need a buyout immediately. But it's critical that governments at least have a plan for what to do with them. Because if not, someone will eventually end up stuck with a home that's worthless. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Turkin, in Norfolk, Virginia.
Sam's story was part of the Pulitzer Center's Connected Coastlines reporting project. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now.